Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Gimel Amud Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara here is quoting from the Mishnah and the differences that are between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot. One of those differences that it noted is that by Dinei Mamonot, Chozrim, Gam L'Skut, Gam L'Chova. When it comes to Dinei Mamonot, we are able to overturn the verdict or the decision, whether it's positive or whether it's negative. Whereas by Dinei Nefashot, we're only allowed to, or we only can overturn the decision if it's positive, meaning to acquit the individual, but if it is to chovah, to indict or incriminate him, we're not allowed to overturn the din. So that part of the Dinei Nefashot we're going to see later as to why that is. Gemara here is going to figure out why it is by Dinei Mamonot that you're allowed to overturn it, and in what circumstances are you allowed to overturn the din. So just as a little way of introduction, first of all, with regards to Dinei Mamonot, it's very different than Dinei Nefashot. Because whenever you talk about Dinei Nefashot, you're talking about an individual who is being indicted by the Beit Din, and now he is a defendant. So anything to incriminate him would be the Chovato, and anything to exonerate him would be the Zchuto. So it's very easy to define what is good and bad, or what's Zchut and Chova over there. Whereas by Dinei Mamonot, by the mere fact that there are two individuals, two balei dinim over here, by definition, a schut for one party is automatically a chuvah for the other party, and a chuvah for one party is a schut for the other party. So to speak about an objective schut or an objective chuvah is much harder by Dinei Mamonot because of that issue, which is that the overturning of a verdict will benefit one party and not benefit the other party. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing to keep in mind is that with regards to mistakes that are made, there is a position that everybody follows, which is that a person who's tab dvar mishnah, a person who makes a mistake with something that is very obvious, obviously explicated in the mishnah, then that is not considered to be a psak din. It doesn't matter how strong a dayan you are. If you make a mistake with regards to an obvious halakha that's found in the Mishnah, that din is vacated, and we will overturn the ruling. The cases where we don't overturn rulings, or we have questions about overturning ruling, are things called shikul adat. It's a question of where you have to use reasoning, you have to use deduction, you have to use extrapolation, where there is more to it than just simply knowing the Mishnah or having an explicit halakha that is out there. So that's the second introduction. And then the third part of the introduction here is that when we are dealing with the Beit Din, we have this tension that exists. There's a dialectical tension between tzedek, justice, emet, coming to the truth. And on the other hand, we want to maintain the integrity of the system, which is that we want to make sure that people respect the Batei Dinim and respect the Dayanim. And so it's important that they carry a certain amount of weight, and that even maybe when they make a mistake, we're going to uphold the decision because we want to uphold the integrity of the system. So we're always challenged when there's either a mistake or we want to change the outcome or the conclusion. We always have to think or weigh the possibilities of how people are going to react to that. Are they going to react positively because we're getting to the truth and justice is being served? Or are we going to have people then start to doubt or question the integrity of the Beit Din or the system itself? And so that challenge will lead us to make different decisions in different situations as to whether overturning a decision is worthwhile or not worthwhile. Just keep that in the back of your mind because it has implications along what we're going to speak about now. So the Gemara now brings Reminu. They bring a Mishnah from Bechorot. The Mishnah in Bechorot says, Danat Adin, if he concluded some monetary matter, Zikat HaChayav, acquitted or made not liable someone who was really liable, Chiyevet HaZakai, or on the other hand, someone who was not liable, he made liable, Timeata Tahor, he made something that was Tahor, Tamei, Tiherata Tamei, or on the other side, he took something that's Tamei and said it was Tahor, Masha Asa Asui, whatever he paskined stands, the conclusion remains, Bishalemi Beito, and he's gotta pay out of pocket. He's on the hook for it because he made the mistake, and he's gonna lose money over the fact that he made a mistake. We're not gonna allow him to overturn the conclusion of the case or the psak din of the case. So this is very different than our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says by monetary matters, we overturn the conclusion, whether it's the chovah or whether it is the schut, we allow an overturning of the conclusion. Now that can happen for one of two reasons. It could happen because there was a mistake made in the conclusion, or it could be because additional evidence is brought to the case that allows us now to change the outcome. So here we're luckily speaking about a case of a mistake. And what we see is in the Mishnah Bechorot, you're not allowed to overturn the conclusion. The Dayan has to pay for the mistake. In our Mishnah, it says you can overturn it and then rectify whatever the situation is. So that's the Gemara's question. How do I reconcile between our Mishnah and the Mishnah in Bechorot? With regards to Tiheret HaTameh that is mentioned in the Mishnah Bechorot, the Balei HaTosafot are troubled by why is it there that he has to be Mishalim? Why does he have to pay? If he just says something that was Tameh is Tahor, then all he has to tell him afterwards is that it is Tameh, and then he can rectify it. Why is there a loss associated with that? The Balei HaTosafot say, well, if you want to suggest that the problem is now that he took that Tameh item and mixed it in with his other items, then that is a suggestion that the Gemara will make further on. The Gemara has yet to make that suggestion, and so there we're pre that suggestion. So what happened here that made it a binding or irreversible type of case? So the Balei HaTosafot here are mechalek between what happens later in the Gemara and what happens here. In this case, the Baal HaBayit himself mixed this fruit into his other fruit. He took the tameh item, mixed it in with his Tahor items. So now, once he does that, you have two possible outcomes. You have one possible outcome where the items that are Tahor are the Rov, and the tameh is the minority, and therefore it'll be Batel Berov, and it'll be fine, because it's Batel Berov, and that's Mashasa Asuit. Whatever is done, and you can't reverse it. On the other hand, if you put it into a mixture that does not have a Rov of Tahor, and it will not be Batel, that's when it'll be Vishalemi Beitel. He's got to pay out of pocket there, because now everything is Tameh because of what he put in there. And that is a direct result of the Pesach that was given. So even though the Baal HaBayit did it, because he did it based on the Pesach Halacha, the Dayan is on the hook for that, and he will have to pay for it in that case. So now we're going to have Amoraim who come in and try to give answers to who reconciled between them. You have four and a half answers here as to how to reconcile those two Mishnayot. So Amar Rav Yosef is the first one. So now there are two different ways to read this Gemara. The Rif reads the Gemara in the following manner. Lo kasha, that's not a problem. Kan b'mumche, kan b'she'enu mumche. And again, based on what the introduction we said before, here we're talking about mistakes that are made by Dayanim and Shikul Adat. Things that are about their reasoning, deduction, extrapolation. The case over here in our Mishnah is a case where he was not a mumche. Since he wasn't a mumche, we can overturn his decision, we can vacate his decision without causing any damage to the system. Since he wasn't an expert, he doesn't represent the system as a whole, and if we overturn his decision, that'll be fine. People won't question the integrity of Bate Dinim, because they know that this guy was not a professional. On the other hand, the Mishnah in Bechorot was speaking of a case where he was a mumche. Since he was a mumche, we won't overturn or vacate his decision, because that would bring questions to the integrity of the system. And so because of that, we'll force the decision to stand, but it's a mistake. So therefore you have to compensate out of pocket to make up for that problem of the mistake that he made. And then the Gemara's question is not Mumche Machzirim, but according to the Rif is Mumche Mishalem. Is it really true that a Mumche has to pay? Vaktani, the Seifa of that Mishnah Bechorot says, Mumche Lebeitin Patur Melishalem. If he was a Mumche, then he's not obligated to pay. He's exempt from making compensation, even though he made a mistake. We'll explain in a second why it is that you would be patur, even though you made a mistake, and that means a litigant is losing out. Rashi explains to us what the logic behind that is. But that is the question of the Gemara now on this position of Rav Yosef, which is how can you claim that the Mishnah in Bechorot is speaking about a mumche in the Reisha, because there it says he has to pay, and then the latter half of the Mishnah there says if he is a mumche, he doesn't have to pay. How are you going to reconcile that? The answer to that is Amar Rav Nachman, Kan she'ish gadol emenu b'chokhma minyan, Kan she'ein gadol emenu b'chokhma minyan. And therefore, Rav Nachman now is coming to answer the problem we raised in Rav Yosef, and now reassert why Rav Yosef's claim is correct, and that the Mishnah in Bechorot is not a stira, and that is because the first half of the Mishnah in Bechorot is speaking about a mumche who is not the top authority. Since he is not the top authority, then he now is forced to pay for his mistake, because he should have counseled or conferred with the higher authority. The fact that he didn't and made a mistake is his problem. And so therefore he's not granted that immunity, and he will have to pay or compensate for the mistake he made. Now then, the latter part of the Mishnah, when it says, Imaya mumche, over there the mumche means a big mumche, the top-notch professional. There's nobody above him. Since there's nobody above him, therefore he doesn't have to pay. He's granted that immunity because of his position. So this is the explanation of the Rif according to the Rosh. And actually, if you look in the Meiri, he helps to understand why the Rif's position is better than the position of Rashi, which we will explain in a second, and he defends that position of the Rif as being correct. On the other hand, Rashi reads the Gemara just the opposite, and that is that when Rav Yosef says over here, mumche and enu mumche, his answer is referencing in the following manner. Our Mishnah is talking about a mumche. Our Mishnah allows you to overturn or vacate the decision because he is a mumche. since he has that stature or standing, that gives him enough power to overturn the decision without people questioning his overturning of the decision. They're going to say to him, wait, why weren't you right the first time? How do you know your second reasoning is right? He says, because I'm a professional. I know I made a mistake. I understand what it is. I'm going to tell you that you have to be bound by my second decision because I made a mistake in my first decision, and people will accept it given his professional authority and his professional standing. On the other hand, the Mishnah in Bichol wrote that says that you cannot overturn the case. That's an individual who's not a mumche l'rabim. Since he's not a mumche, people will not abide by his change in mind. The litigant who loses out by his change in mind will say to him, how do you know your second logic is better than your first logic? You say, well, I made a mistake. Well, so how do you know you're not making a mistake this time and the first logic was better than the second logic? He can't then flash a professional card and say, I'm a professional and that's why you have to listen to me because I'm definitely right. That's not true. He's not a professional judge over here. He's not a mumche. And therefore, he's not granted the ability to overturn the case because he doesn't have that type of authority that he can then bind the litigants to his second decision versus his first decision. So there we'll let the case stand or force him to have the case stand, but then he'll have to compensate out of pocket to make whole on the mistake that he made. Then the Gemara's question is, is it really true that a mumche is allowed to overturn the case? And then the Sefer, the Mishnah Bechorah, says, Im haya mumche, enu mishalim. If he was a mumche, he doesn't pay. Now the only reason he wouldn't have to pay is because there would be a possibility of thinking you had to pay. You would only have to pay if the decision stands. If the decision is vacated, why would you have to pay? You just changed the decision. Now everything is right and rectified. The only way you would say that you're exempt from payment is if you leave the whole decision intact. And so it seems from the Mishnah Bechorot that when you have a mumche, we leave the decision intact, he's just exempt from payment. So how do you deal with that? So from now, we reject Rav Yosef, and then it's almost as if the Gemara says, Elo Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman offers an alternative explanation to reconcile between the two Mishnayot. The truth is that you could probably also use Rav Nachman's answer then to solve the question of Rav Yosef. But Rav Nachman comes up with the following answer, and again here Rashi reads just the opposite of the Rif, which is, here it's a case where the individual has other authorities that are higher than him. Here he does not have authorities that sit above him. And as Rashi explains over here, when it comes to the case of our Mishnah, there we will allow him to overturn the case because there are higher authorities. Since there are higher authorities that sit above him, he can either lay the blame on the change on the appellate court. It went to the appellate court, and the appellate court remanded it to him and said, you've made a mistake in your decision, please review. He says, I reviewed it. So that's number one. Number two is he can say that the appellate court will give affirmation to his change in mind. The higher authority will then back his second decision because that is the right decision. And then that will maintain the integrity of the system because there's a higher authority saying that his reversal is proper. And then the Mishnah in Bechorot is speaking about a case where there is no higher authority than he. So then if he was to overturn his decision, first of all, why would he be overturning the decision? That would be an undermining of the integrity of the system. Plus, he has nobody to lay the blame on. He can't say, oh, there was somebody above me that demanded that I overturn it, or there's nobody above him to affirm the second part of his decision. So in that case, we will let the case stand. And since it stands, now, in a case where you're not a mumche, you'll have to pay. In a case where you are a mumche, you'll be exempt from payment. But in that way, Rav Nachman offers us an alternative way to reconcile between the Mishnah in Bechorot versus our Mishnah here. Although you could see how this answer of Rav Nachman, even according to Rashi, could also be used to answer the question that we posed on Rav Yosef. Balei HaTosafot point out over here, and this is something that's questionable throughout the Masechta, we discussed it a little bit in the first parak, is when the Gemara uses the term mumche, is that synonymous with smicha? Or is there such a concept as a mumche l'rabim that is not smicha? And what the Balei HaTosafot point out over here, based on the Gemara on Hey Amud Aleph, where we find that someone who is a mumche had to pay, Tosafot then creates three different categories of judges. There's someone who's not a mumche at all, there's someone who is a mumche l'rabim, and then there's someone who's a mumche l'rabim who has smicha. And what the Balei HaTosafot suggests over here is the person who's allowed to reverse his position and is indemnified in that case and doesn't have to pay for damages in an alternate case, that's a case where you talk about a mumche with smicha. And that's what Tosafot says over here, Yesh Lomar, the mumche d'acha and a mumche d'smicha. It's not just a mumche d'rabim, it's a mumche with smicha. So Tosafot creates tiered categories that include a mumche with smicha, mumche without smicha, and then a non-mumche. And in that way, he tries to reconcile the Gemara in Hey Amud Aleph with our Gemara over here, which is also drawing a distinction between a mumche and an eno mumche. All right, there's one thing, it's a very important Rashi over here, Rashi says, how is it possible that if a mumcha makes a mistake, that he's patur min l'shalim? That means that in this situation, we know the truth, and the truth is that we got the case wrong, and despite that fact, we're leaving the individual with the loss of money. So in the beginning, in the first part of the Mishnah in Bechorot, it says that they has to pay. When he's not a mumcha, he has to pay. So in that situation, we're rectified. One guy got more money than he should have, fine. But the guy who lost money now was reimbursed, and so he didn't lose the money. But in the latter part of that Mishnah, where it says if he's a mumcha, he doesn't have to pay, then you have verdicts or decisions by which we know it's a mistake. And despite the fact that it's a mistake, we say patur min l'shalem, that he's off the hook. So listen to what Rashi says about that. Kevan de mumchehu, since he is a mumche, mazla bisha de haugavra garmle lemite. It was the bad luck, the bad mazel of this defendant or litigant here that caused the mistake to happen from this mumche. A mumche is expected not to make a mistake. And therefore, if he makes a mistake, it's considered to be out of the ordinary, extraordinary, not something you would expect. So if he makes a mistake and he is then indemnified, he does not have to pay. Nevertheless, we do not, that's despite the fact that we know it's wrong, and a party's gonna lose, we say that was his bad luck. His bad luck was the one case, or the outlying case, where he made a mistake, was this case. And that's your bad mazel that caused it. So Rashi tries to explain why we would leave a mistaken verdict intact, despite the fact that someone is actually losing out money over here, and it's problematic. So he says in the end that we blame it on that litigant, because it's his bad mazel that caused it. So anyway, it's a very interesting Rashi trying to explain why we would leave a loss in place, despite the fact that we know that there's a problem in the decision. All right, Rav Sheshet Amar, here we have either a second or third attempt to reconcile the Mishnah. Kan sheta'ab dvar Mishnah, kan sheta'ab shikula dat. Depends what type of mistake was made. If it's a mistake in a Mishnah, which is, again, something that's obvious, then you're allowed to overturn the decision. And people can't really question the decision or the overturning of the decision because it's an explicit mission. You can just look it up and you can see it. Kan etab shikul adat, in a mistake that involves decision-making, deduction, reasoning, over there, if he changes his mind, we're not going to allow him to overturn the conclusion of the case because that will start to bring questions as to the integrity of the judge or why we should listen to this reasoning versus the other reasoning before. The Amar Rav Sheshet, Amar Rav Asi, Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah Chuzer. Someone who makes a mistake with regards to an explicit Mishnah, you can back away from it, you can overturn the conclusion. Ta'ab Shigul Adat, if you make a mistake in reasoning, Eino Chuzer, you don't have a right to vacate the decision. Amar Le Ravina Le Ravashi, how far does that go? Where is the line between Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah and Ta'ab Shigul Adat? Afilu Ta'ab Rav Chiya Rav Hoshaya? What about Rav Chiya and Rav Hoshaya, who are they? Compilers of the Braitot, what is their status? If you find something explicitly in a Braita, is that considered to be a Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah, or is that considered to be a Ta'ab Shikul Adat? Rabbi, who's the compiler of the Mishnah, when he's Sotem a Mishnah, like a certain position, we assume that that's the Halacha, and we follow it, because Rabbi, number one, his stature as the Nasi, as well as the concluder of those generations, who had then gathered all the information of the previous Tanaim, and he's able to make decisions based on that. Plus, since he's the Nasi, the whole yeshiva, everybody's learning by him, so there is a way to check. When he's trying to decide something, there are challenges from the students and from those that are present, and that way you come to a better conclusion. On the other hand, Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Hoshaya were compiling the Braitot, whereas they are in the same position as Rabbi, they lack the stature of being a Nasi, and therefore not everyone is learning by them, and so you don't get as much clarity. So that's the question here. Does that still count as Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah? And he answered him yes, in the affirmative. That is still considered to be a Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah. Afilu b'Rav Shmuel? Even by Rav Shmuel, a member of Rav Shmuel, would you consider that to be a Ta'ab Dvar Mishnah? He said yes. So now over here, there are two ways to read what it means Rav Shmuel. It could be that it's a member of an Amora like Rav Shmuel, which is Rav says something, an unchallenged statement. Does that carry the weight of a Mishnah or a Braita, which is considered to be a Talmud of our Mishnah? And same thing with Shmuel. When he makes an uncontested statement, does that carry the weight like a Mishnah or a Braita? And his answer is yes. That their uncontested statements are on the same level or same plane as a Mishnah or a Braita, because you can just look it up and you can see. On the other hand, the other way to read this, you can see that in the Rabbeinu Hananel, Klomar, Im Ta'av Asab Yisurei Kishmuel Ubimamon Kirav. We know the principle in Halacha is Halacha Kirav Bisurei. Halacha Kishmuel b'mamon. So that is a klali apsak. So the question then is, if you reverse that and you paskin like Shmuel in Isurim, or you paskin like Rab Bima Mamunot, is that considered to be a Tav Dvar Mishnah? And that could be the way you're reading, and he's answering in the affirmative that that is a Tav Dvar Mishnah. So that means even a machloket between Rab and Shmuel, but we know the principles that guide us as to when the law is like Rab and when it's like Shmuel. If you went against those principles, is that considered to be a Tav Dvar Mishnah? And his answer is in the affirmative. So it's very different the way that the Rabbeinu Chanan reads it versus the other way to read it, which is the uncontested statements of Rab and Shmuel. Then he says, Afilu b'didi b'didach. So now we have the conversation here is between Ravina and Ravashi. Ravina and Ravashi were the Sof HaRa'ah, the compilers of the Gemara. And so Ravina now poses to Ravashi, are we on that same status as Rav and Shmuel? Meaning that when we make a statement in the Gemara and we have a Memra, does that carry the weight of Rav and Shmuel? Or does it not carry the weight of Rav and Shmuel? And he answers him, Amalei, Atu Anan, Katle Kane, Ba'agma Anan? What are we, woodcutters, reed cutters from the swamp? What, we don't have a status as an Amora? So if we're a status of an Amora, we're no different than Rav and Shmuel. If there's a Memra that we have and a Masorah that we have, or a conclusion that we come to, that is a binding statement. And therefore, if someone makes a mistake in that statement, then it's considered to be a Tav Dvar Mishnah. So what we're saying is that the scope of Tav Dvar Mishnah is greatly expanded here. It's not really literally Mishnayot, it's rather anything that is clear cut. Anything where it doesn't require any real thought, just knowledge of the Memra, which is whether it's a Memra of Tanaim, that's in the Mishnah, a member of Tanaim that is in the Braitot, a member of Amoraim like Rav and Shmuel, or a member of Amoraim even like Ravina and Ravashi. So anything that is clear-cut, and now according to Rabbeinu Chanan means clear-cut in the way that we would paskin the Klalei Apsak over here, or according to the other way we viewed it, it means that when they have uncontested statements, do they carry the weight like a Mishnah? And the answer is yes. So now the Gemara says, Hei chidami shikuladat. You've expanded the scope of Tav Dvar Mishnah so greatly, then what is left to be considered shikuladat? Samra papa kigon shrei tana'ei or shrei amorai. It's a case we have a machloket tana'im or a machloket amoraim. Diplige adodi, they argue, velo itmar hilchata lo kemar velo kemar. And we don't have any conclusion in the Gemara as to whom the halacha is like. We don't know if the halacha is like this amora or that amora. The Gemara never makes any explicit statement. Or in a Mishnah, we don't have any addressing by the Gemara as to whether the halacha is this way or that way. And then this judge, based on his reasoning and his thought process, decided to pass an halacha like one of these two opinions. But the sugya seems to favor the other party. So now, Rashi writes over here, so Rashi writes that it's not that the sugya, but that the majority of Dayanim disagree with his position. So he's in the minority over here. And so that's a Tav Shikuladat. Majority of Dayanim seem to favor the other position, even though the Gemara never had any conclusion, but the Dayanim are saying, we think that the conclusion is with this party. And he is a minority now in deciding against that position. So that's what's called Tav Shikuladat. That's the way Rashi reads it. I think that the other way to read it is that sometimes, even if the Gemara is not explicit about its psak halacha, like halacha karab yisure, halacha shmol bedine, there is sometimes evidence, circumstantial evidence in the Gemara that indicates the psak is like one of the two positions. And that is either when you have two Amoraim are arguing, and then the Gemara continues afterwards to only discuss one of the two opinions. The fact that the Gemara takes the time to reconcile and work out that position shows or indicates that the Gemara is leaning in favor of that position. So even though the Gemara never says anything, and never paskins halacha like either party, and the Klalei Apsak don't deal with this, nevertheless, by the fact that the Gemara invests time in discussing that opinion and dedicates pages of the Gemara to discussing it, might be indicative of the fact that it's halacha. That might be what it means, the sugya of the Shmaitata, that the Gemara's sugya seems to follow that position. The other thing is, where we have evidence from other cases in Shas, which is that over here you see a machloket, but in other places in Shas, the Gemara seems to assume like one of those two opinions. And the rest of Shas, or many places in Shas, the Gemara will just move on as if it's a given that one of those two positions is correct. So in either of those cases, then you have some indication from the way the Gemara treats the two that the halacha is like one over the other. In that case, it might be a Tav Shikuladat. Look, you could go in either way here, but if you look at the circumstantial evidence, it seems that the Gemara is favoring one of those two positions. That's another way to read what it means over here about Tav Shikul HaDat versus Rashi, who seems to think that there is a majority of poskim that follow one opinion, and you are in that minority that don't follow that opinion. That's considered to be Tav Shikul HaDat. Eighth way, Rav Amnuna or Rav Sheshet. So now Rav Amnuna challenges Rav Sheshet's explanation here to reconcile between that in Bechorot and that in our Mishnah, which is that the case in Bechorot is Tav Shikul HaDat. That's why the case or the decision stands. And our Mishnah is a case of Tav Bedvar Mishnah, and that's why we overturn it. Maaseh Bepara, there was a case with a cow, Shenitna Aim Shela, that its womb was removed, Bechila Rabbi Tarfon LeKlavim. And Rabbi Tarfon decided that the cow is a trefa, and therefore he fed it to the dogs, because it can't be used for meat, can't be eaten, so all it's good for is for dog meat, and so he fed it to the dogs. We're going to see in a second in the Gemara that it's not literally that he fed it to the dogs, but the owner of the animal gave it to the dogs based on the psak of Rabbi Tarfon. Uvama said lifnei chachamim. This incident came to the chachamim in Yavne. Vihiti ruah. And they were matir. They said that it is not a treifa. Bipnei she'amar todus harofe. Because we have testimony from todus the doctor. No cow and no pig leaves Alexandria of Mitzrayim unless they cut out its womb so that it's unable to reproduce. So this is the way that the Egyptians protected their intellectual property, which is that they say we have the best cows, we have the best pigs, and we want people to use them, and we can export them. But if we export them, then the people who buy them from us are going to start to make their own pigs and own cows by using ours and then having them reproduce. And then they'll be able to simulate our quote-unquote technology over here. And then we'll lose our competitive advantage. So how are we going to prevent people from copying us or reproducing what we have? We will sell or we'll export these items, but we'll export them in a condition where they can't reproduce. That is, we're going to remove the womb from the pig or remove the womb from the cow, so that they are unable to reproduce. The Todos HaRofeh testifies to the fact that that was a common practice in Alexandria of Mitzrayim. If that was a practice, then it obviously does not cause the animal to be a trefa. A trefa will die either very soon or within the next 12 months. No party is going to be buying a chazir or a cow from Mitzrayim knowing that it's going to last less than 12 months. They're not going to have much of an export business doing that. It must be that when you remove the womb, that the animal survives without any problem. If that's the case, it's not a treifa. And that's what they did in Mitzrayim. Protect their technology or their competitive advantage. It's worth looking at the Chizkuni and some of the other Mefarshim by the Agalot that Yosef sends to his father Yaakov when he's in Mitzrayim, inviting his father to come back down. And over there, the question, the Psukim, which talks about the Agalot from Paro, or the Agalot from Yosef. And over there, the Chizkuni discusses this Mishnah as to how the Egyptians protected their technology, and it wasn't just in this area that they did such things. So now, Amar Rabbi Tarfon, Halcha Chomorcha Tarfon. He says, you just lost a donkey, Rabbi Tarfon. He was bemoaning the fact that now he's going to have to pay for the fact that he made a mistake here. He caused somebody to lose their animal in an incorrect decision, and therefore now he's on the hook, and he's got to pay for that. So now, first of all, Rabbi Tarfon happened to be very wealthy, so it probably wasn't a big deal for him, but I think he wanted to display or show that it was a problem, that what he had done was a mistake that was costly, and that he took seriously, and that he was going to have to compensate the person who lost out because of his decision. So what you see over here is that even when you have someone who's Tav Bedvar Mishnah, Rabbi Tarfon was making a mistake about something that's an explicit Mishnah in Chulin, and he made a mistake about the Psak, that an animal's aim that's taken out, whose womb is taken out, is not considered to be a trefa. Now, if he's Tav Bedvar Mishnah, you should vacate the decision. The only reason Rabbi Tarfon would have to pay is because the decision stands and he has to rectify the mistake. So the fact that he's having to pay over here is already indicative of the fact that this decision is going to stand. Why should the decision stand according to you, Rav Sheshet? Rav Sheshet, didn't you tell us, Tav Bedvar Mishnah, you're Choser? So Amalo, Rabbi Akiva, Patur Ata. You're exempt. Shekol HaMumcha L'Rabim, Patur Min L'Shalei. Anybody who is of the status of a Mumcha L'Rabim does not have to pay. So again here, the question about whether the word Mumcha L'Rabim exists, the word Rabim should be here, whether it should be Mumcha L'Beitin, then that goes back to the Tosafot, whether this Mumcha over here is simply a Mumcha L'Rabim or a Mumcha that has Smicha. But therefore, you are now exempt from payment. You do not have liability in this case. Ve'ita, if you're right, Rav Sheshet, le'melah toeh b'dvar mishnata, toeh b'dvar mishnah chozer. Forget about not having to pay or being exempt from payment or liability over here. Just reverse the case. You are toeh b'dvar mishnah, you're allowed to reverse the case. Why isn't Rabbi Akiva assuaging Rabbi Tarfon with that answer? Where it says, chadava od kamar. No, Rabbi Akiva was giving him multiple reasons as to why you shouldn't worry. First of all, you made a mistake about a Mishnah, and you make a mistake about a Mishnah, you can vacate the decision, now reverse the decision. It's not a problem. Even if your mistake had not been about a Mishnah, but about something in reasoning, you are exempt anyway. Because you are mumcheh l'rabim, you are granted that indemnification, and therefore you don't have to pay in this case. So now the Gemara answers that by saying chad ba'od kamar. The problem is that there is flaw in the whole logic that's going on over here. The Gemara is bringing a challenge from Rav Hamnuna to Rav Sheshet's position from the Mishnah Bechorot that talks about this issue with the parah. That is very problematic, because the Mishnah explicitly says that they fed the cow to the dogs. So what is the question? Hamnuna is saying, oh, Rav Sheshet, did you say Talmud Bar Mishnah is Chozer? What do you mean Talmud Bar Mishnah is Chozer? That's true if you can reverse the case. But maybe you can't reverse the case. The animal was fed to the dogs already. What are you going to reverse? There's nothing to reverse. There's nothing left here anymore. So what was Rav Hamnuna's question to start with on Rav Sheshet? And that's what Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak L'Rovo, Ma'ikam Motiv Rav Hamnuna L'Rav Sheshet Mipara. What is Rav Hamnuna asking Rav Sheshet from Para? It's not even relevant to our case of Yeril. Para, hari echila leklavim. The para is fed to the dogs. Veleta the tahad there. It's no longer extant to be able to be returned. So what was the question on the position to start with? Roba answers of Nachman Yitzchak and says, Hachika amarle. This is what he's telling him. Iamart bishlama ta b'dvar mishnah enu chuzer. If you believe someone who makes a mistake of a mishnah cannot reverse the case, alma kam dina. That means that the verdict or the decision is binding. Hainu de kamafkin Rabbi Tarfon. That's why Rabbi Tarfon was afraid that he would have to pay. Bekamarle iho. And then Rabbi Akiva assuages him and says, Mumcha lebeitim ata, vata patur min l'shalem. His fear about having to pay is because the case is going to stand. And since the case is going to stand, he's going to be out of pocket to rectify the situation. Rabbi Akiva comes and tells him, don't worry about it. Even if the case stands, you're a mumcha, and therefore you are a patur. If you tell me that a person who makes a mistake in a Mishnah, you can't overturn the case or the conclusion, then Rabbi Tarfon should be able to say to the owner of this cow that if the cow was still around, then we would vacate the decision, and I'd be able to reverse that which I said because the cow's around. And I didn't do anything. Meaning that I didn't cause any loss, I didn't cause any problem, because we can reverse the situation. Hashtanami, lao klumavat. So too, in this case, you didn't do anything. Which means, and the logic here, I'm going to tell you, is not so easy and not so simple to understand. The Gemara basically says here that if you uphold the decision, that makes it a binding decision. And since the decision is what causes the problem, therefore, you are on the hook for it, and you'd have to pay for it. And that's what Rabbi Tarfon's afraid of. He's going to have to pay for it. Rabbi Akiva comes and says, don't worry about it. Even though it is a psak din, and even though you're responsible for that psak din, you don't have to pay because you're a mumcha. Since you're a mumcha, you are exempt from having to make such payment. You have no liability in the case. And then it goes back to the Rashi we saw earlier. The party that brought the question is going to lose out here because of his mazla bisha, his bad luck, that the mumcha made a mistake on the day that he came to court. On the other hand, if you believe that had the cow been here, you would have been able to reverse the decision, it basically means that there was no psak din rendered. It was a mistake, and it's automatically vacated. So it's automatically vacated, you would give back the parah to the original owner and tell him it's not a trefa. So what we're saying is that you have no responsibility because a mistake was made. And the mistake could be rectified by just handing the cow back. But that means, in a case where the cow doesn't exist, you still are exempt because it was a mistake. And a mistake means that he destroyed this cow or fed it to the dogs of his own volition. Because you never gave up psak din. You made a mistake. and your mistake made it that there wasn't a psak din, and then there's no reliance by him on a psak din, that now he can say you are responsible for it. So obviously the logic is difficult only because it was his mistake that caused the guy to go and act that way. What do you want him to do? Ignore the psak beit din, even though the psak beit din is a mistake? And so that's what makes the logic very hard, but the Gemara is saying that when it's a mistake, it's not considered as if you relied on a psak din, and therefore the judge should be responsible. The judge made a mistake, and that mistake made it that there is no psak din here. And therefore, when you did whatever you did with your treifa, or your supposed treifa, you did it of your own volition, because there was no psak which you were relying on. Now, Tosfot here makes two things clear. One is, obviously, this is a case where Rabbi Tarfon himself did not get involved personally in feeding the treifa to the dogs, because then there would be what's called nasam natan biyad, which we'll see in a second in the Gemara, makes him liable, as well as the fact that he thinks that this Gemara is following the position of the Chachamim, who say that you are patur for dinei de garmin. Because over here, despite the fact that you are the proximate cause of the problem, we are still saying that you are patur. Whereas Rabbi Meir would believe when you have dinei de garmin, even though you're not the direct cause, even if you are an indirect cause, but you are the proximate cause, then you would be responsible to pay. So it has to be here that we're speaking according to the position of the Chachamim that are not dayin dinei de garmin. Tosfot is compelled to do that because of a stira from a Gemara in Bechorot. All right, so now the Gemara continues now with Rav Chisda, which is now your fourth attempt to reconcile the Mishnah and the two Mishnayot. Rav Chisda Amar, Kan Shenatal Benatan Beyad, or Nasa Benatan Beyad is the way Rashi has the Girsa. Kan Shelo Natal Benatan or Nasa Benatan Beyad. Depends as whether the judge got personally involved in the decision that he made. In a case where he didn't personally get involved in the decision, then in that case, he doesn't have to pay, because he didn't do anything that would make him liable over here. On the other hand, in the case in Bechorot, he personally got involved and physically made the exchange between the parties, or did something to the detriment of a party, and that's why he's on the hook for it, because he actually got involved physically, and he is directly the cause of the nezek that happened over here. So now the Gemara goes on to, let's understand this. Our Mishnah, we understand, is a case where he didn't get involved, he just gave up psak din, and that's it. But the case in Bechorot has a number of scenarios. So Bishlam Achiv et Zakai, in a case where he obligated the innocent party, Kagon Shenas Natal V'Natan B'Yad, it's a case where he took the money from the party who was obligated to pay, despite the fact that they were not liable in this case. So when he does that, he takes the money physically from him and hands it to the other party. So in that case, we understand what means Nasa V'Natan B'Yad, that he got involved in the case. He took money from one party who was not liable and paid it to the other party who he claimed this party was liable to. So in that case, he got involved by paying the money. Now, Zike et Chayav Heche Mishkakala, if he exempts or claims that the party is not liable when they're really liable, that's a passive decision. That's not an active decision. He's saying you don't have to pay. Well, if you don't have to pay, he's not going to get involved physically. There's nothing to move. Everything stays as the status quo. And so therefore, the Gemara is questioning, how do you have Nasav and Natan B'Yad in that case in Bechorot, if you have a situation in which his physical involvement doesn't really have any implications? Where it says, Zamalei Patur Ata. He said, you are not liable. V'halo Natal V'Natan B'Yad. Okay, so he said, you're patur. What does that do for you? What does it have to do with getting personally and physically involved in the case? Because when he says you're patur, it's as if he went and took the money from the rightful owner and gave it to this party. Even though nothing really happened, this party already has the money in their hands and they're just not paying for it. You just exempted them from payment. You told them that they weren't liable. So even though there's nothing that moves and no money that changes hands, your mere declaration that patur atam l'shalem is the equivalent of moving the money from its rightful owner to the party that's holding it now, even though no money ever moved hands. Gemara says, okay, wait, that's an interesting explanation, but that's going to throw a monkey wrench in our Mishnah. How are you going to explain our Mishnah now that says that you are able to reverse a conclusion in a case or a decision in a case, whether it's to the benefit or to the detriment? I understand in a case where it's for the betterment of the party, that you can have a case. Originally, paskin that you are liable, and he didn't physically get involved in moving the money to the other party. So he made a mistake. He never got physically involved with the case. He simply said, you owe the money to the other party. You are liable. And that person then went ahead and paid. So then he can reverse the case and demand that he give the money back. Ela lechova hecha mishkachala. Where is the case of chova when you're going to reverse to the chova? Damale paturata. It must be a case where he said to the party that was liable, you are exempt. You're not liable. And then he comes back and says, you know what, I made a mistake. You really are liable. You really do have to pay over here. But that means that his opening statement was paturata milishalem, that you're exempt. Ba'amar, didn't you already tell us? Kevin damarle paturata kamoshnatam natam biyadami. You just told me when you say paturata milishalem, that's the equivalent of being physically involved in the case. And then that would make him liable in that case. Mar says, chodok tani, the case in our Mishnah is actually one big case. It's not two separate cases, one of zchut and one of chovah. One in a case where he obligated, and then he said you are not obligated. And then the other one being that he said you are not liable, and then made him liable. That's the way we're reading it till now. Where it says, no, it's all one big case. Dinim mamonot, machzirin zchut, shi chovah. When it comes to dinim mamonot, we will allow you to reverse a decision, which is beneficial, but is also a chovah. Because, and this is what we said at the part of the introduction, that whenever you have a monetary case, there is a beneficiary, and then there is a loser, or someone to whom the decision is to their detriment. So over here, the case here is a case where, dinim imanot machzirin, you're allowed to overturn a case, lischut, in a case where you paskin that the person is liable, and then he was gonna have to pay money in that case to fulfill the liability that he was chayavin. And then he goes ahead and he pays the other person, or you don't get physically involved, and then the person says, you know what, I made a mistake, and you weren't liable. Now, when you do that, it is to the benefit of the party who was not liable, but it's to the detriment of the party who had received the money and thought he was going to get paid out because the liability really did exist. And so what the Gemara is saying is that the Mishnah only entertains that one case, and in that one case, there's no poter milishalim. That he never makes that statement, so there's never an asav natan biyad, because the only case in the Mishnah is a case where he said you were chayav, and then he changed his mind and said you are a patur. Dekavata gabei nefashot. Now, what's the equivalent case by nefashot? Machzirin l'schut, ve'ein machzirin l'chuva. The Mishnah says, by dini nefashot, you can overturn the decision when it comes to something that is to his benefit. L'chuva, on the other hand, when it's something that's to his detriment, you can't overturn the decision. Machzirin l'schut, so when he says that he overturns it in his favor, zchut gredita. That is just a plain piece of evidence that is to his benefit. Vei machzirin l'chuva. You're not allowed to do that when it comes to something that's to his detriment. Zchut shi chuva. That you're now going to interpret based on what you're saying by dinei mamonot. That means it's something that was beneficial to him, but it's to the detriment of another party. That doesn't make sense because the fundamental difference between dinei mamonot and dinei nefashot is what I explained in the introduction, which is dinei mamonot involves two parties, and therefore there's one party that benefits and one party that loses no matter which way you go. But dinei nefashot, it is the system, the courts, the state, which is prosecuting this individual for violations that require capital punishment. But there's no other party on the other side. There's no claimant and defendant. There are no two litigants here. There's simply one party that is being accused by the Beit Din of doing something wrong. And now they're bringing him to trial over that wrong. So now, if you make something that is to his benefit, whose chova, whose detriment is that for? And you just told me that the only case of dinim mamonot that makes sense in our Mishnah is a case where it is a schut for one, but to the chova of another party. So if you're going to try to create that or simulate that by dinim nefashot, what exactly is the case that is the schut shi chova? You can't do something beneficial to him that's a chovah to someone else. Chov de deman. Who else is going to be in this case that is detrimental to by dinei nefashot? It says, halokasha, there is a case like that. Chov de gol adam. To the detriment of the familial member that had suffered the loss. In the case where you now, you overturn a case, l'schut, for the benefit of the accused murderer over here, overturning the case in his favor, it's good for him. It's a schut, because now he won't be subject to the death penalty. But on the other hand, the family of the victim are sorely disappointed. They wanted to see the person who had killed their beloved one be brought to justice and then executed so that he pays, quote-unquote, for the murder of their relative. Now that you are now going to overturn the case in his favor, he won't be subject to the death penalty anymore. That's a real detriment towards the Gol Adam or to his dismay that it won't be handled. So Gemara says, wow, you now are telling me, Mishum Chovtei the Gol Adam, Katlinin Leleh the High, says, wait a minute, you're telling me now, because it would be to the detriment of the Gol Adam, we'd rather leave the case in place, kill an innocent individual, because we don't want the Gol Adam to suffer any negative consequences. That seems ludicrous, that we would then uphold the decision and not allow a zchut, not allow a merit to overturn the case, and then acquit this individual because we're worried about it being negative for the Gol Adam? That makes no sense. That's number one. V'od, my ben. In the Mishnah, it's very hard to argue that it's one case, which is what we're saying now, that the one case of the Mishnah is a case where it is a zchut, a merit for that party, but turns out to be the detriment of another party. The Mishnah doesn't say zchut and chovah, it says ben zchut, ben the chovah. The fact that it repeats the word ben twice seems to indicate that we're talking about two disparate cases and not one single case that is a zchut that includes a chovah. And so for both of those questions or those reasons, the Gemara now rejects that the suggestion of Rav Chisda that the difference between our Mishnah and the Braita is this difference between being engaged physically, now 7 out of 10 bayad, versus a case where he's not engaged physically. And the Mishnah Bechorot is speaking about a case where he's physically involved, and the case in our Mishnah is a case where he's not physically involved. So now Rav Ina comes, and he basically tries to save the answer of Chisda. And he does it by explaining the following. Rav Ina Markagon, Shayala Biyado Mashkon Vinatalo Emeno. Our whole problem with Rav Chisda's explanation is, how do you have a case where the Psak Halacha is patur, no liability, which means that he doesn't have to move anything. He can't physically be involved in the case. And then when he overturns it, the chovah, we say, oh, he can't do it. But you told me the Mishnah in Bechorot is a case where he's no seven otem biyad. Where is there no seven otem biyad in a case where he paskins not liable? Rav Chisda tried to suggest that Torah Tamil Shalem is the equivalent of moving the money from one party to the other. Ravina gives a different way to understand that and says the following. The case where he exempted the person from liability, in that case, he took the mashkon, the collateral that the creditor was holding, and he hands it back to the debtor. So in that way, he undermined the collateral that this person was holding in order to get the repayment of indebtedness or liability that was owed to him. So now when the judge intervenes and takes the mashkon away and hands it back to the debtor or to the owner of the mashkon, he now has done something beyond to undermine the collection rights or ability of the creditor. And so now he was involved physically with the object, and that's what's going to make him liable in that case in Bechorot. So now we found a way for the judge to be active in the case, physically involved in the case, which will then make him liable, even in a case where he is coming to a psak halacha of patur. Timei et tahor, what about making something tahor tamei? What did he do there physically? He just declared it to be tamei. Da'agi be sheretz. He brought a sheretz and he dropped it on top of it. He says, I know you don't know if it's tamei or tahor. You have a safek. I'm telling you with such certainty that it is tamei, I'm going to show you that how tamei I think it is. I'm going to bring a sheretz and put it right on top of there. So if you had any questions until now as to whether it's tamei, it is tamei now. Because I'm telling you, that's the psak, and I'm going to make sure that you have no doubts in your mind that is the psak. Tiereta tamei, what about a case where he says the item is tahor? How does he have any liability there where he's getting involved physically? He's simply declaring it not to be tamei. She'irvan ben peirotav. It's a case where the judge then took it and mixed it up with the other peirot of the individual who was bringing the question to him. Person questioned whether this is tamei or tahor, and he paskins tahor. He took the items, and after he said they were tahor, and he tosses them into the remainder of the fruits of this individual. Now he realizes it was a mistake, and the item was really tamei. He did something physically with the item. He took this tamei item, and he physically put it with the other items or the other fruits. And that's what's going to make him liable over here. And this goes back to the Baal Yetzer Tosafot that I mentioned earlier, that they say the Gemara here is the first time indicates that it's a case where he mixed up the peirot. So how do we explain the Mishnah in Bechorot before we knew this answer? How do you explain the fact that he's going to be liable in this case? And so the Baal Yetzer Tosafot answer over there, that it depends who mixed it up. Ravina is suggesting is that the mixing was done by the judge himself. And that's what makes him liable in this case. Before, it was a case where the Baal HaBayit mixed them up. And since the Baal HaBayit mixed them up, that's what makes the judge who's not a mumche liable, but a judge who is a mumche would not be liable in that case. But the reason there is a loss is because the Baal HaBayit took them based on the psak and then mixed them in with his fruits or his other fruits. So that's how Tosafot distinguishes the conclusion of the Gemara here. and the earlier part of the Gemara, they both believe it was mixed up. The question was, who mixed it up? Early on, we were thinking it was the individual who had the question who was mixing it up. And now we're saying, no, it was the judge himself who was mixing it up, and that's what makes him liable over here. And now the Gemara moves on to Dinei Nefashot. It says here, by Dinei Nefashot, you're only allowed to overturn it, l'zchut, and not l'chuvah. Tanu Rabbanan, minayin liyotzei mibeit din chayav. How do we know that a person leaves Beit Din being indicted? V'amar achat yesh li l'mod alav zchut. An individual says, I have something that is positive, something that could be in his defense. Minayin shemachzirin oto. How do we know that, first of all, first you bring him back to discuss it? And number two is that you would overturn the decision if there was substance to what was being said here. Tamalom ra naki al tarog. Someone who is innocent, you're not allowed to kill. Uminani yotsemi beit din zakai. How do we know that somebody leaves the court after being acquitted? V'amar achat yeshli lalameda lav chova. And then one of the parties says, you know what? I figured out some evidence that would actually incriminate him in this case. How do we know that you can't go and reverse that decision? Tamalomar tzaddik al tarog. Do not kill the tzaddik. So here the Gemara is making a distinction between naki and tzaddik. Naki is the true standing of the individual, meaning that the innocent individual is naki. He's completely clean. He has no guilt whatsoever. And then they have the tzaddik describes a standing that is granted to him from the court. He is not necessarily innocent, but the court declares him to be tzaddik, that he was right in this situation, or he is given his rights in this situation, which means that they freed him or acquitted him in the case, but he's not necessarily innocent in the case. And so that's what the Gemara is saying. In both of those instances, you do not have a right to kill him. When he's naki, when he's innocent, you do not have a right to kill him, and that's why if we get more information that would acquit him, you have to go back and reopen the case to deliberate and decide that, because this could save him. You know how to kill somebody who is innocent. So naki, al tarog. On the other hand, if he already emerged from baked and innocent, we apply what is today the principle called double jeopardy. Once you have been tried for something and a decision has been rendered, you don't have a right to bring it back to reopen the decision on that case. And since he emerged from baked and acquitted, doesn't mean he was innocent, but since he emerged from baked and acquitted, we no longer have a right to bring him back to trial in order to reopen the case with deliberations that would then lead to a decision to incriminate him. Amar Rav Shimi Barashi, v'chulufa l'meisit. Even though that's true in all capital cases, there is one exception to that rule, which we already saw earlier, and that is the case of meisit, someone who is convincing others to worship avodah zarah. Dichtev, lo tachmol, v'lo techaseh alav. You may not have mercy, you may not cover up for him. So from that we learned earlier, that means that you can't do things in his favor, which means you can't look for skuyot, and seemingly it would be the other way around, that if we found something to his detriment, we would allow you to reverse the case or reopen the case against him. Rav Kahana Matne, another Rav Kahana, uses this as the source, Mifi Harog Tehargenu, that over there by the Mesit, it says that you should kill him. I mean that we are looking for evidence, we are looking for reasons to put him to death, and therefore we would favor information that would allow us to put him to death. And so that means that if you have a detrimental thing to say, we'll reopen the deliberations. If you have something to his defense, we will not reopen the deliberations about it. So Baimine Rabbi Zera mi Rav Sheshet. So now Rabbi Zera asks of Rav Sheshet, how far does this division of Dinei Nefashot versus Dinei Ma'amarot carry? What is subsumed under the category of Dinei Nefashot? Chayvei Galiot Mai. When it comes to someone or a case that involves having to go to Galut, go into an exile for killing Mishogeg, are they classified as being Dinei Nefashot so that you cannot overturn the case? It says, Atya Rotzeach Rotzeach. We have a Gzera Shova from the word Rotzeach. By the Rotzeach B'mezid, it says, Yumat HaRotzeach, that the Rotzeach will be put to death. And it says, by the person that did it Mishogeg, Lanu Shama Rotzeach, that the killer will run to the Ir Miklat, the city of refuge. So that Gzera Shova teaches us that the person who runs to the city of refuge is in the same position as a Rotzeach, a murderer, that did it intentionally. And just like the murderer who did it intentionally, you're not allowed to say things or reverse the decision, L'chova, to his detriment. You are allowed to reopen the case for his betterment. So too will be the same din with regards to Chayavei Galiot. Chayavei Malkiot, Tmai. When it comes to corporal punishment, what is the din there? Are you allowed to overturn it to his detriment or only to his betterment? Rav Sheshet answers Rabbi Zera, and says, Atya Rasha Rasha. We have Xerish over there as well, which is by Dinin Efashot, it says, Asher Hu Rasha Lamut. And by Chayvei Malkiot, it says, V'ayayim Bin Hakol Tarasha. So you have Rasha Rasha, and that Xerish Shava says that the Din will be the same by corporal punishment, which is that you're only allowed to overturn for the positive and not overturn for the negative. You're not allowed to overturn the case when it's to the detriment of the party. That's only if the mistake wasn't so obvious, if it's so explicit in the psukim, that even the psukim would admit to this din, then in that case, even if it's overturning at the chovah, we still will do it. Because over there, the decision that should have been rendered is so obvious because it's an explicit pasuk. And so explicit that the tzukim agreed to this halacha. Tzukim only believe in Torah Shebichtav and not Torah Shebaal Peh. So that's evidence of the fact that it's so obvious when they know that halacha. So if he makes a mistake in such halacha, we'll overturn the case, even the chovah, because in that case, the decision he rendered was so obviously wrong, to overturn it, whether it's the chovah or the zchut. So that's why if he makes a mistake about something that's not explicit in the psukim, because over there, you can say that it stands and we won't change it to his detriment. Then if he makes a mistake about something that's so explicit that even the psukim agreed to this halacha, zilkari beirabhu. That's like, go learn. Go to cheder. If you know the psukim, you would have known the answer to this question. And therefore, we will overturn the case, even the chovah, because it's so obvious that the decision is wrong over here. Vaymine Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba mi Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba now queries of Rabbi Yochanan. Ta'ab no'ef no'ef et ma'u. If he makes a mistake with regards to a case of adultery, what is the case? So Amalei, so now Rabbi Yochanan gives him back a seemingly cryptic answer, which is, Ademokdach yakid, before your fire burns out, zil kotz karach betzlei. Go ahead and then pick your gourd and roast it. So now, Rashi reads it in the following manner, which is, Taba no'ef no'efet is, what mistake could you make for the zchut of a no'ef no'efet? I mean that a no'ef no'efet is such an obvious and explicit case restricting against adultery, then what exactly mistake could you have made over there? In other types of capital cases where it's not as explicit in the psukim, like for instance the case of murder, where you have to get the right murder weapon, it has to be a murder weapon that is strong enough to kill in that case. I mean that there are a lot of factors that are not explicit in the psukim that govern the way that you would decide in that case. And then when it comes to no'ef no'efet, that says so obvious and so straightforward, the definition of the words of no'ef no'efet means adultery. It's so obvious and explicit that there's no schut, there's nothing you could say that would be to their benefit that would not be able to be reversed. Mean that you should be able to reverse whatever the decision is made because of that. So then Rabbi Yochanan answers back to him and says, while the fire is still going, meaning when you're reviewing your shmaitata, you're going over your learning, your girsa, ten leiv lavin ulosif lekach. Don't just be a robot and just repeat it over and over again and just say it so you know it baal peh, but put your mind to it. Think about it. Harei shamata mimeni ta'ab dvar tzukim odim bo chozer. He says, you just heard from me that if it's a mistake about something that the tzukim agreed to, then you reverse it. And no'ef no'efet is something that's so explicit and obvious in the psukim that even the tzukim agreed to it. If that's the case, then you know what the answer would be. The answer would be that you can overturn that type of case of no'ef no'efet. What Rabbi Yochanan was saying to him is, listen, don't just be a robot repeating and just learning over your girsa. Just put your mind to it. If you just extrapolate from what I said, you would have come to an answer by yourself. So that's the way Rashi reads it. The Balei Tosafot disagree with 2 points that Rashi makes. First of all, they say that no'ef no'efet, the question here is not that there is no zchut possible that you could make a mistake that's not already explicit in the psukim. That's just not true. And he brings evidence to that fact. But he says the Eish Lomar, he thinks that the question that's being posed over here by Rav Chiya Ba'aba to Rav Yochanan is the following. Is there any outcome or decision in the case of no'ef no'efet that the tzukim would not agree to? And then Rabbi Yochanan responds to him and says, while the fire is hot, pick your gourd and put it in there. He's saying to him, listen, just like I explained to you before, that there is a distinction in halacha between things that the tzukim agree to and things that the tzukim don't agree to. You know that that is a distinction that's made, so you yourself should be able to figure out what are the cases where that is true and what are the cases where that is not true. Take it into your own hands to understand when they do agree and when they won't agree with this. And then you'll get the answer to your question, which is, what is a case no eif no efet where the tzukim are not modebo? So whereas Rashi thinks that the case no eif no efet is really a fundamental question on this statement of Rabbi Yochanan, which says that you can have things that are and not admitted to by the tzukim. The case no eif no efet, there is no case where the tzukim don't admit. And that's why he's asking Rabbi Yochanan, where exactly do you draw your distinction in that case? And Rabbi Yochanan comes back to him and says, listen, while you're going over, put your mind to it and figure out from what you learned from me, which is, you're right, there is no distinction over here. And then in the Baal Tosafot, see the question being, please explain to me, what's an issue where the Tzukim don't agree over here? And then the answer Rabbi Yochanan says is, you figure it out. You know, I already explained it to you. You figure out what is halacha no if no effort that the Tzukim are not agreed to. And then the Gemara, according to that view in Tosafot, says, Ketzad, where is that case? What is that situation? That's what Gemara says, Amra Itmar Nami, Amra Biyame, Rabbi Yochanan, Tabanoif Choser. In a case where a mistake's made about adultery, you go back or you can reverse the decision. Elehechi Dami Ein Chozrin. So then where is the scenario where you don't go back when there is a mistake in Psak that the Tzukim don't agree to? Rebao, Amra Rabbi Yochanan, Kigon Shita'a Shalokidarka. You made a mistake about Aloko of Shalokidarka. So here Rashi explains that Shalokidarka means that there are two ways in order to engage physically with a woman. Kidarka, which is the normal way that a man would engage with a woman, or Shalokidarka, which is not the normal way that he would engage with the woman, but is a possibility of engaging sexually with the woman. And that we learn out from the word Mishkevei Isha, which is written in plural in the Pasuk. So it's a limud or a drusha from the Pasuk. So the Tzukim don't agree to that. And that's the case of which is that you are liable for adultery both by Kidarka and Shalo Kidarka, whereas the Tzukim would only agree Kidarka. So if he makes a mistake in an issue with regards to Shalo Kidarka, then that'd be something that you would not reverse if it was the Chova, because that's not something that the Tzukim agreed to. Now then, if it was a mistake on issue of Kidarka, where the Tzukim do agree, then you would reverse it, even the Chova, because it's such an obvious mistake. The Baal Tosafot reject that and say that even the Tzukim agree to Shalok and Darka as well. So that can't be the halacha that's being discussed over here, but rather, the halachic difference or distinction that's being discussed over here is the difference of Bia Kedarka. Bia Darka, in order to be Chayav for adultery, only requires what's called Heara, penetration by the tip, whereas Shalok and Darka is not classified as Bia, to be liable for adultery until you have gemar bia, until you have a complete intercourse with the woman. So that distinction about how much penetration you need or how far along does the intercourse need to go before you're being liable, that's a distinction of limud by the chachamim that requires drashot, and that clearly the tzukim don't agree to. If he makes a mistake in that, the case will stand. If he paskins positively for the individual, now you want to come back and reverse the chova, that we would not allow you to do. Then, if you make a mistake with regards to Kedarka, Shlokedarka, that just basic items, the noif, no effort, where the Tzukim agree, over there, even if it's the Chova, will allow you to reverse the decision, because it's so obvious that you were wrong. Now the Gemara says, Dinim Amamanot, when it comes to monetary matters, anybody can speak up, positively or negatively. As by Dinim Afashot, you're only allowed to speak up, Lizchut, you're only allowed to speak up for the betterment of the individual. A kol, what does it mean anybody can speak up? Who is the kol here? Mar says, Vafilu Edim, even the witnesses, even a witness who came and testified against the party to their liability or to their detriment, if they think of something that would be to the benefit of that party or good for that party, they can speak up. Mar says, Neima Matzit, Rabbi Yossi ben Rabbi Yehuda. Maybe that means that our mission is authored by Rabbi Yossi ben Yehuda below Rabbanan. The Tanya Vabraita, Veid Echad Lo Yaneh Ben Nefesh. A single aid may not testify against a person. Ben l'schut, ben l'chova. That is in either direction. Meaning that a single aid has no right, whether it is to speak beneficially or detrimentally about the party, they don't have a right to speak up. Once they've testified and given their testimony, they're out of the case. They have nothing more to say. He's allowed to intervene when it's to the benefit of the party. He can't intervene when it's to the detriment of the party, meaning that a single aid can make a difference. So now if you're telling me that a kol means anybody can come in to the benefit of the party, and you're saying that includes edim, that would seemingly be only possible according to Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. According to the Chachamim, the aid can't do anything here. Ben the Skud, Ben the Chuva, you can't be involved in the case at all once you've given your testimony. Then Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda says it depends. You're going to bring up a negative point now, we won't let you do it. You want to bring up a positive point, that's fine. Amar Rav Papa, so Rav Papa gives an alternative as to what it means that anybody can speak up. L'schut, that is Be'achad min ha-talmidim v'divrei ha-kol. It's one of the students that sit in the rows before the Chachamim of the Beit Din. So one of those students speaks up. They're allowed to speak up only when they're bringing a positive statement. They can't speak up if they're going to bring a negative statement. And so then the Gemara says, my time under Rav Yossi Rav Yehuda. Gemara now tries to delve into what's the reasoning behind Rav Yossi Rav Yehuda's position where he distinguishes between an aid changing their mind, the chova, versus an aid changing their mind, the zchut. The Amar Kral, the pasuk says, aid achad lo yaneh benefesh lamut. It says, one witness may not testify against a person to put them to death. Lamutu de'enu oneh. He's not allowed to testify them in a situation that will cause death. Aval the zchut oneh. On the other hand, if it's something that's to the benefit of that party, then we will allow him to speak up. So he basically makes a diuk in the pasuk that says a preclusion of the eid achad speaking up is only in a case where it's lamut, where it's something that's detrimental. But if it's something that's positive, then we will allow him to speak up. Rabbanan, Amarish Lakish Mishum, the Mechsek Inogebe Yuto. Rabbanan do not agree with that because it looks like he is self-dealing or face-saving by doing this. That is because we have a principle on halacha, Kevin Shehigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid. Once an aid is given testimony, he does not have the right to reverse his testimony, unless he does it toch kedei dibur. But if he doesn't do it toch kedei dibur, he's not allowed to change his testimony at a later date. He's not allowed to reverse that which he put into the record. So now what the Chachamim are saying is, if you allow this individual to later on intercede on behalf of the defendant, even though your testimony was to his detriment, then what he's doing in essence is undermining his testimony without actually undermining it. He's precluded from changing his mind or saying anything at this point because once he's testified, he's locked into that testimony. But now he's scared. He lied under oath. He told a non-truth in order to implicate this individual. If the Beit Din figures this out and they bring an edim that are mezimim, that make him to an edzomim, he's now going to be killed. He's going to be on the hook for what he said. And so what he wants to do is undo his testimony without actually reversing his testimony. So he can't reverse his testimony because he's precluded from doing that. So how does he unwind his testimony without unwinding his testimony? He intercedes with a merit for the party. He intercedes with something positive to say. So in the end, the verdict will come out in favor of the party, and he won't be then subject to being an eid zomeim because there was no gemar din against this party. So that gives him the ability to overturn his testimony without actually overturning his testimony. And that's why the Chachamim say you can't allow for that. Rabbanan hai lamut, my darshibe. So the Chachamim, what do they do with the pasuk over here about lamut? Mukmilei bechad min ha-talmidim. They set it up with one of the talmidim, like Rav Papa had suggested before, that one of the talmidim is allowed to speak up positively, but not negatively. Okay, Netanya, and it's similar to this breita. Amar echad min ha-edim, yesh lelamed alav zchut. One of the edim speaks up and says, I have something to his benefit. I have something that could acquit him here. Can I speak up? How do we know we don't listen to eight? Tamalomar, eight achad lo yaneh. So the Gemara here is going to parse the pasuk in different ways in order to get the conclusions they want. Which is the first thing they say, it says, eight achad lo yaneh. A single aid or an aid at all may not speak up lo yaneh. Not the shkut, not the chuvah, they can't speak up at all. How do we know if one of the students spoke up and says I have something to his detriment, something to incriminate him that we don't listen? So now the Gemara reparses the pasuk and says, leave out the first word aid, and they add in the word at the end of the pasuk of lamut. So now it reads as echad lo yaneh benefesh lamut. A single individual may not testify to the detriment of this party. Which means that no matter who they are, not an aid, but any single party doesn't have a right to testify to the detriment, implying that if it was to the betterment of that individual to acquit him, they would be able to speak up. And so that's the halacha, that a talmid has a right to speak up when it is to the benefit of the defendant. He may not speak up if it's to the detriment of the defendant. On the other hand, when it comes to an aide, according to the Chachamim, an aide is precluded from testifying in either situation. He can't testify the chuvah, he can't testify the zchut, because an aide is out of the picture once they testify, because we don't want him trying to save himself by bringing in extra evidence to acquit the individual so that he won't be on the hook for lying under oath. Okay, we're going to stop here with the two dots on the top of Lamed Daled Amud Aleph.